Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. We've already raised enough to pay for 11 months worth of episodes of this show. We're going to keep the fundraising drive going until we've got a full year covered. Please give if you can afford to. Today, Nate welcomes Richard Aquila to talk about rock and roll during the Kennedy administration. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Richard Aquila, author of Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, A Cultural History of the Early 1960s. Richard, welcome. Apologies for butchering your name.
That's okay, fine. Pleasure to be with you.
So I love this book. This is a period of time that, when I was taught about rock and roll history, was written off as the Dark Ages. Elvis joins the army, Jerry Lee's disgraced, Little Richard finds Jesus, Buddy Holly dies in a plane crash, John Lennon says everything's bad until the Beatles came along and there we go. But this is actually a great era of rock and roll. It's incredibly rich, and it's also a unique period in American cultural history after the election of John F. Kennedy and before the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Tell us about this period and why you chose to write about it.
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. First off, on a personal level, okay, as a baby boomer, I grew up with rock and roll music. I was there when the music was born in the 1950s. It offered a soundtrack to my high school years in the early 1960s, and I witnessed the changes, the important changes that occurred once the British rock invasion hits in 1964. And all through it, the music was reflecting a certain mood, changing mood of the United States in those years. And I always intuitively suspected that. And then later on, I went to graduate school and got a PhD in American history. And the more I read in terms of history, one of the new things that began emerging during the 1980s and 1990s was something called the New Social History, where it looked at history from the bottom up, the grassroots, rather than just top down looking at all of the major figures in American history. And what dawned on me as I was going through that PhD program was that rock and roll music fit that description perfectly. I mean, what you're talking about is a grassroots music, and it shows the importance of popular culture, that for many people, rock and roll was extremely important in their lives, myself included. And I set out to try to prove that in terms of how the music reflects the times, because that's what we're really talking about. And for most historians during those years, they didn't want to deal with rock and roll music at all. I mean, their attitude was, that's not real history. It's not even real music. In some cases, it was what they argued. And I was trying to show essentially how important their music was during those years.
And I think you succeeded. There's a great story you tell in the introduction about a Lieber and Stoller song, Only in America. And we discussed this on the show in the past. This was a song, you know, Only in America, and it was a hit for Jay and the Americans in a very much a flag-waving way. But that's not the original concept Lieber and Stoller had. Who'd they write it for originally?
Well, originally it was going to be with the Drifters, and the Drifters are a black rhythm and blues group during that time period, date back to the 1950s. And they underwent numerous changes as far as personnel, and Lieber and Stoller saw it as a perfect example for that group. And their record label wanted nothing to do with that because essentially one of the lyrics in the songs was only in America could a poor boy grow up and become president. And the record company said, wait a second, we don't want to hear a black person singing that line. It's going to cause lots of problems in the South and elsewhere because of what was going on with civil rights in the 1950s and early 1960s. And so Lieber and Stoller were convinced it was a great song and they wanted to use a song. So they brought in Jay and the Americans, a white pop rock group, to do that song. And in fact, all Lieber and Stoller did is they erased the vocals. They used the music track that they already laid down and they had Jay and the Americans singing it. And as Lieber and Stoller later pointed out, once they made that change, and they said even the name of the group, Jay and the Americans, plugged right into the patriotism of the late 1950s and early 1960s. And the song shot right up to the top of the charts, coming at top 10 hit.
Yeah, it's a fascinating snapshot of the period, and I think it's well chosen. That says a lot about the politics of the period. I mean, on the one hand, black groups like the Drifters, and this is the Drifters 2.0 with Benny King and others that came along, and Lieber and Stoller have been working with them since 1959 through a legendary run of singles. So these groups had much higher profile than similar African-American groups would have had just 10 and definitely 20 years earlier. You had a few groups like the Mills Brothers and then the Ink Spots, and then the whole bird group thing, the Ravens, the Crows, the Orioles, et cetera. And then you get this new wave of singers and it creates more space, and there's more space for African-Americans to make their mark, but it's still not a relaxed enough environment for a black group to be able to do a song like Only in America that frankly just comes off sounding, there's a lot more levels of meaning to it when the Drifters do it. Not that we got to hear it, but you can, you know, there's just a lot more politics involved when you have a group of marginalized oppressed group praising the nation that's oppressed them. And so, you know, the Jay and the Americans was a perfect early 60s solution. Let's get some white kids in there with some nice pearly teeth. Go ahead.
And you know something, Nate? One of the reasons why I started out with that song is because it does something. Not just the lyrics in terms of capturing what was going on during that time period, but that backstory. Right. And the point I was trying to make there in terms of the introduction was sometimes the music is pretty straightforward in terms of what the message is and everything else. Other times, you got to dig a little deeper to see what's going on there. It's almost like peeling an onion in different layers. And as you get down there and you realize what's going on with that song, there's far more going on there than meets the eye in terms of that song. So, yeah, you're right when you say that. I mean, essentially, that's what this entire book is all about. That is trying to, regardless of what song we're talking about, whether it's a song by the Drifters or whether it's a song by Elvis Presley, who's changing directions during that time period, or whether it's a song by Frankie Avalon or Fabian, those songs tell you something about the times. And as an historian, that's one of the things I'm interested in here, that if I was writing the book as a music critic, I could talk about, you know, this was a good song, this is a bad song, but that was not my primary purpose here. That creeps in there, obviously, in terms of things that I write about and everything else. But by the same token, what I'm trying to show is that all forms of popular culture, including popular music during those years, tell you something about the listeners, tell you something about the times. And that's what this book tries to get at.
Yeah, absolutely. Every song is a political statement. Every recording artist musical career as a political statement. And I, you know, we do a music history show here and we try to avoid the what's good and what's bad stuff as well. Although sometimes you just can't help it. I mean, some stuff is obviously, just has more impact and more meaning to more people, and other stuff, sometimes there's just clunkers that are out there. But let's go ahead and hear a little bit of music. And this is Stupid Cupid by Connie Francis. When we come back, we'll talk about Neil Sedaka, Howard Greenfield, and the Brill Building. Cupid, you're a real mean guy. I'd like to clip your wings so you can fly. I'm in love and it's a crying shame. And I know that you're the one to blame. Stupid Cupid. Hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. And that was Stupid Cupid by Connie Francis, written by Neil Sedaka and Howard Greenfield. And that's probably not the ideal song, but it's a fun one, and I wanted to pick it. The two songs I want to talk about, though, and I'm assuming most people have either heard them or can go find them easily, but one thing I like about the way you did this book was you're not doing a critical history, so you're free to look at things dispassionately, and you do a great sort of cross-section of what were the various players or the various movements in rock and roll in this period from 1960 to 1963, and you lead with a chapter or a section called New Directions that has four chapters. And I thought this was a really interesting way to carve up what you lead with and what was new, what were the new directions in the early 60s. And you pick essentially neo-doo-wop, which is a term I hadn't heard before, but I think is perfect. What does neo-doo-wop mean? Who is doing it? And how is it different from original doo-wop?
Well, it differs in a couple of ways. What happens is after 1960, there are going to be all sorts of changes cutting across different styles of rock music during that time period. A lot of it comes out of the Brill Building in terms of the types of songs and the instrumentation. I mean, using violins, using French horns sometimes, timpani. I mean, all sorts of things you wouldn't have heard back in the 1950s. And doo-wop essentially refers to, it's sort of a second wave of doo-wop music that hits. The earlier doo-wop in the 1950s was far more R&B oriented in terms of coming out of rhythm and blues music, whereas neo-doo-wop was much more of a blend between those R&B influences during the 1950s, but also some of these new influences that begin to hit. And I think it's, again, trying to put this into context, you got to remember something, that the baby boom generation hits high school in 1960. That's the vanguard of the baby boomers. People born in 1946 are just hitting high school as Kennedy is elected president. That generation, that baby boom generation, and arguably it's the second rock and roll generation. The first generation would have been those kids who came of age during the 1950s and cheered on Elvis Presley and Presley Mania when it hits in 1956. And now, though, here's the second generation of rock and roll fans, and the music that they were listening to in some ways was quite different in terms of the sound, and neo-doo-wop is a good example of that. It's far more pop-oriented than some of the earlier doo-wop that you had in the 1950s. Not completely, because a perfect example would be the Marcel's Blue Moon. I mean, that is straight out of R&B in terms of the sounds, the doo-wop sounds that you find in that song. But still, what you're talking about is it's different. It's, you know, it sounds more modern to ears of the early 1960s than some of the more R&B influenced doo-wop earlier on.
Yeah.
And there's a whole slew of new groups as well.
Yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but I think one of the things about Blue Moon is it's a Rodgers and Hart classic song, and it's already been done by numerous rock and roll performers, including Elvis Presley by this point. And the chord structure becomes so common in doo-wop songs in this era that the Beatles just called that chord structure the doo-wop. The doo-wop, I can't remember now what I'm blanking on the what you call chord structure, but anyway, that's not relevant. But it was the doo-wop changes. Okay. That's right, the changes. It was the doo-wop changes, and it becomes this massively dominant form. When the Beatles or other songwriters later on want to evoke the 50s, this is the chord sequence they're going to use to do that. And it was really surprising and fascinating to me to learn, oh wow, that didn't become a big thing until the late 50s, way late in the 50s. And this, you know, these groups tend to be more integrated, a lot of groups, and also a lot more Italian and outer borough, not integrated groups. A lot more white artists are doing doo-wop in this period, but it's definitely different. And you talk a little bit about the Tokens and their classic, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which has a long chain of origin. Can you run through that quickly?
That was a fascinating story behind The Lion Sleeps Tonight, because lots of people today are familiar with that song because it appears in movies and everything else, and there's a second generation of that. And one of the people I interviewed for this book was Jay Siegel, who sang lead on The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And he told a fascinating story in terms of how that song came about and how they even brought in an opera singer to sing a high part that was just one notch above his falsetto. And it worked brilliantly in terms of the instrumentation and the singing in that. And what was very surprising with that song is that song actually originated with Solomon Linda, a Zulu, and his group in Africa much earlier on. The song, as far as most people were concerned, it sort of never makes it anywhere. I mean, it was sort of an early folk song that Solomon Linda was singing about a lion in the jungle. And that song is then eventually going to find its way into the hands of Pete Seeger. And Seeger just fell in love with the song and was trying to figure out what he was hearing in the original that was being done, and sort of changes it, the refrain, a whim away, a whim away, that he sings throughout, was sort of a variation on the Zulu word meaning lion. And it was absolutely a phenomenal song from that perspective. And Jay Siegel of the Tokens was listening to a Pete Seeger concert on the radio in the 50s, and that's where he first heard that song. And he thought to himself, oh, I could sing that kind of falsetto. And that song basically then is transformed into the Tokens, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which had all sorts of different interactions as far as the style. And it mixes all sorts of stuff in there, including folk music, from that perspective. And in some ways, when I was talking to Jay Siegel, I found it interesting, because one of the things I didn't know is Jay Siegel told me, he said, look, when we first came out, he said, sometimes we even had a banjo player with us because we did a lot of folk songs in our set. And his record label actually would book them onto college campuses, and they would sing, you know, half the songs they would do would be folk songs. So from that perspective, it's almost an early glimpse of what comes to be known later on as folk rock. Blending together rock and roll beats and some rock and roll harmonies with folk style lyrics. And it really, from my perspective, when I was talking to Jay Siegel, I found it fascinating when you try to trace the origins of some of these songs, because it's like different streams or currents of popular music that are running together. And at that particular moment emerges this Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Yeah, I love that image too. Several threads coming together to make this beautiful new knot, which is the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And, you know, Jay Siegel's one of these guys who should have gotten a writer's credit. He added new verse structures, new verse melodies, and new lyrics to it, and got jacked, frankly, on that. But I didn't realize how involved he had been in the production. And he appears multiple times in this book as kind of an A&R guy, not just the leader of the Tokens, but producing other songs as well. So that was informative and interesting to learn about. But let's hear our next song. This is Leaving Here by Eddie Holland. Eddie Holland, of course, is going to go on to be part of the Holland Dozier Holland songwriting team with his brother Brian and Lamont Dozier, who are going to write and produce the hits that keep the Supremes at the top of the charts at the height of Beatlemania. This is Leaving Here by Eddie Holland. that was some early Motown. That was Leaving Here by Eddie Hall. And this is a song that's going to go on to be covered by The Who and many other British artists. Pretty definitive early Motown track. And tell us, Motown obviously is one of the other sections in this New Directions chapter. Tell us about Motown and how you connected it to the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, Motown emerges from Detroit. I mean, it really is sort of the sounds of Detroit that are going on there. And Berry Gordy had had some success as a songwriter, writing some songs for Jackie Wilson earlier on. And it was a fascinating story that I had to compress in that chapter, basically, that shows the links between Berry Gordy's family growing up in a family atmosphere, and he recreates that family atmosphere for Motown. And what you're talking about in the early 1960s is the rise of this black label, black artists, black producers, black songwriters, black ownership. And in effect, what's going on is when people are talking later on about black power, black economic power in the 1960s, there's no better example than Berry Gordy and Motown. And it was sort of a family atmosphere in terms of what they developed there in Motown. And the songs, the artists, I mean, you go through some of the artists during that time period. And this is all what I'm writing about it in this book is the early 1960s when Motown's just getting off the ground. And this is pre-Supremes. At that point, they were anything but Supreme because they had issued several releases, but everyone was a flop. It's not until later on that they begin having their mega hits and become a supergroup. But what you're talking about during that time period are some phenomenal songs. One of their first big hits was Money, done by Barrett Strong. And to this day, you listen to that song, and it's just a solid rocker in terms of the sound itself. And it's almost crass in terms of materialism that he wants money. You know, they say the best things in life are free, but, you know, tell it to the birds and bees, I want money. That's what I want, sings Barrett Strong. I mean, and what you find are these songs during this time period with a wonderful studio band. And as I was getting into this, one of the things I realized is it is the same studio band playing behind all these different artists on the Motown label. And Martha Reeves of the Vandellas, when I interviewed her, she pointed out that band that they had, the studio band in Motown, she said they were brilliant musicians, and most of them had a jazz background, and they added that sound to what they were doing. She said, but they had an uncanny ability to tailor their music to whichever group they were backing up. And she said, when they performed behind the Vandellas, she said, it sounds very different than when they're performing behind the Temptations or the Miracles or any other group during that time period. So, I mean, it was truly something. And one of the things that's extremely important, I think, that I try to get at in this book is when you link rock and roll during those years in terms of what's going on with civil rights, you really get a different perspective on the civil rights movement and how it's emerging in all different ways during those years, including in music. And during that time period, for example, what we're dealing with is, if you take a look at the African-American population of the United States in the early 1960s, it was 11% of America's population. But in 1960, 30% of all top 40 hits were done by blacks. By 1963, it's 36% done by blacks, which seems to suggest to me that what's happening here is a couple of things: more opportunities for black singers, more of a receptive audience in terms of whites who wanted to hear black sounds. And because you really have to put it in context of the entire rise of the civil rights movement and the blossoming of the civil rights movement during that time period. And Berry Gordy Jr. and Motown, it's not just putting the music out there, and whites could listen to that music and appreciate the music, but also behind the scenes, what you're looking at is locally in Detroit, Motown played a very important role in terms of the local community, trying to do various things, helping out groups. At one point, Berry Gordy and Motown actually are going to release an album of civil rights leaders speaking at various marches. So, I mean, there really is a very close connection there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe he did put out some Martin Luther King speeches as well, and had a gospel network. And he may or may not have worked with the great C.L. Franklin, who is one of the dominant preachers in Detroit and the father of Aretha Franklin as well. But yeah, that stuff's all tied in. And I kind of jumped Motown ahead of girl groups, which you talk about as well. But girl groups are a new thing in this period. And they're kind of a proto-feminism. Talk a little bit about, you know, the Shirelles and the Chiffons and Luther Dixon and the production work he was doing there at Scepter Records. And just tell us about girl groups. What was new and what was so revolutionary about groups like that?
Okay, a couple of things. First off, I think, you know, let's just back it up for a moment here, because, I mean, girl groups unto themselves weren't that different. I mean, you could go back and find girl groups earlier on in the 1940s, like the Andrews Sisters, for example. By the 1950s, what was different is girl groups began performing rock and roll. Black girl groups like the Chantels, for example, the Bobettes were another one, as well as white girl groups like the Ponytails. Those are sort of the antecedents for what comes later. But in 1960, the whole girl group thing just explodes, becomes extremely popular during that time period. And leading the way in the very beginning are the Shirelles. I mean, the Shirelles, again, starting back in the late 1950s, had a hit record called Mama Said. And later on, they're going to do even better, because what they'll do is they'll wind up performing lots of songs that were written by brill building writers. Will You Love Me Tomorrow? Carole King and Jerry Goffin wrote that one. And that song is absolutely phenomenal in terms of what it does, because that song is a perfect blend of an R&B sound coming out of the 1950s with all of these new trappings coming out of the Brill Building, including violins and the way the music was structured during those years. And the lyrics too, Jerry Goffin's lyrics were fascinating because they pick up on one of the things that certainly a lot of teenagers were thinking about in the early 1960s, as well as teenagers of any era, and that is romance and sex and love and sex. And that keeps appearing certainly in a lot of the songs from that time period. But the Shirelles are going to essentially lead the way in the rise of the group phenomenon. They become the first African-American girl group to record a number one record. And that song, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, along with their earlier hit, Tonight's the Night, were far more sexual in terms of the lyrics and the kinds of things that they were talking about. So from that perspective, it really plugs into some of the changing things that are happening during those years, that a lot of these teenagers, going back to the baby boomers hitting high school that same year, that the Shirelles are making it with Will You Love Me Tomorrow. I mean, those are the kinds of things certainly that are reflecting what's going on for many of those young teenagers during those years. And even the title of that section, what does a girl do, a song rather obscure one by the Shirelles, gets at this question, and it's almost proto-feminist in one sense, because essentially the question that's being asked in the song is, you know, boys are always the ones who are leading the way. That's the way it was in society during that time period. But what does a girl do if a girl wants to ask a boy out, or a girl wants to propose, or a girl wants to take the lead in any way whatsoever? And that's one of the themes running through that chapter in terms of what's going on as far as the changing times. But girl groups during those years truly are going to give a voice to young women in the early 1960s.
Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, I want to ask you a little bit about the Dick Clark tours and how it brought these two strains together, the girl groups and also, you know, Motown and other black pop artists, and how they defended themselves collectively against the old segregated South.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And so, yeah, I thought your analysis of these two things, Motown and the connection to civil rights and the girl groups and the way it pointed towards, it wasn't explicitly feminist, but it definitely is raising the profile and the presence, not just of singers, but also songwriters like Carole King and, you know, Cynthia Weil and Ellie Greenberg. There were lots of women making a big impact in the Brill Building at this point. But these groups, you know, and in Motown are mostly the children of black folks who had migrated up from the South. And the same with a lot of the New York groups. And so when these, somebody like Dick Clark would put together a package tour, and he might have a couple of these neo-doo-wop groups, and he might have a couple girl groups. He wouldn't have a Motown act, but, you know, he'd have some analogous groups, and Motown would have their own package tour. Tell us some of the stories about these integrated groups interacting with a still very ugly segregated South that's just about, you know, segregation is about to be broken by the civil rights movement over these very years we're discussing.
Nate, one of the revelations for me doing the research for this book came through things, all sorts of things that I read, but also from interviews that I did with various people. And one of the things that struck me that I had never really read about was all of these tours that were going on, cross-country tours during that time period. And we're not talking, it's not like today where you would have these headliners going out there and they perform and everything else, and everything's very well organized, and Ticketmaster selling tickets, and all sorts of problems stemming from that. What we're talking about coming out of the 1950s and into the early 1960s is, in some cases, these were school buses that somebody would rent the bus, and they load up the bus and take a group of performers in various places for one night stands. And they would hit various parts of the United States, including the South. And what was fascinating to me is aboard these buses, and again, there's no major performer, but what we're talking about are, in some cases, 10 to 15 different acts. And each act would get up there, and if they were lucky enough to have a hit record, they'd perform their hit song, or maybe a couple hit songs, and that was it. And they would step down, and then the next person would come out, and that person would do their hits. And it would go on like that for the next hour or hour and a half. So it was sort of a nonstop, if you will, hit after hit being performed by both black artists and white artists. And these artists that are riding these buses on these tours, and Dick Clark dubbed his the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars. They featured all of the big hits in terms of things that he would play on American Bandstand or that you would hear on Top 40 radio, starting in the late 1950s and then into the early 1960s. And what would go on is, here you have all of these groups and single artists, didn't know each other in most cases, may have bumped into each other doing various types of package tours. But here they are aboard these buses on these tour groups. And I remember interviewing Bobby V, who had numerous hits, including number one record, Take Good Care of My Baby. And Bobby V made the comment, because V appeared on many of these tours. And at the time, when he started out, he was 18 years old. And then throughout the early 1960s, he was still performing on American Bandstand doing these. So still he's in his late teens or early 20s. And Bobby V said, here you had a group of blacks and whites, males and females. And he said, we had to get along. He said, there's no way you can't get along if you're going out on tour for a month. Whatever the problems are, you work them out. And Bobby V said something I thought that was rather interesting. And he said, I don't remember even one occasion where there was a problem, a race problem on the bus. He said the problems came in when we pulled into certain towns, particularly in the South, because, and again, you got to put this into context here, this is the same time where freedom riders heading, from the North, buses of blacks and whites, civil rights workers, would travel down South trying to desegregate rest stops along the way. And there would be a hostile reaction to those buses. And in many cases, as these tour buses headed South, they would run into problems. And when I say South, or when Bobby V was talking South, sometimes we're talking, you know, by the time you get to Cincinnati, that's where you began running into these kinds of problems. So it's not just the Deep South, but obviously the farther south you went, the more problems you ran into. But specifically what would happen is, and I can remember, there are several incidents that I talk about in the book, because I kept getting the same story from everybody I was interviewing, because I always ask them this question about the tour buses and what was it like during an era of civil rights. And they said it was horrible when we wound up going into the Deep South. And the reason it was horrible is because for the first time, we were hit in the face with this notion of segregation, where whites on the bus would be taken to a really good hotel to stay in, and blacks had to go to a different area on the other side of town, and in many cases, staying in somebody's home. Or on other occasions, as these buses would pull into bus stops and to get gasoline, but also refreshments and using the restrooms and everything else, they would run into problems with the Southern white owners of those restaurants who refused to serve them. And on more than one occasion, Dick Clark would stand up tall, basically, and say, either you serve all of us or you serve no one. And if the restaurant owner didn't budge, Clark then would basically take everybody on the bus and get them back onto the bus, and they'd pull out until they could get someplace that would serve them, or they would get takeout in some cases, or even cook in terms of their own food. And time after time, some of these people, from Bo Diddley to whites who were touring on those buses, would talk about how wonderful Dick Clark was. That what Clark did is he treated everybody with respect, and he made sure that, you know, he was in charge of these tours, and he was emceeing these concerts every single night, and he made sure no one was disrespected by people. And it's sort of an insight into Dick Clark that people lose track of, I think, over the years, because Clark's going to have a totally different image later on. But it truly was an example with these tour buses of they were sort of
Freedom riders in their own right, little yeah, integrated islands of resistance.
It really is. I mean, these are civil rights in motion on these buses is what's going on.
Let me jump in
time after time
and cue our next song real quick. This is One Fine Day by the Chiffons. That was one of the great girl groups in question, the Chiffons, doing One Fine Day. And the next section, the last thing group that you have in this New Direction section is surf music. Tell us a little bit about Dick Dale and his partnership with Leo Fender and how this collision of technology and a really unique coastal subculture comes together to impact the nation's music.
Yeah, it really does. And I mean, I was fortunate enough to be able to interview Dick Dale, and it was a phenomenal interview. I mean, he was known for dynamic performances on stage, and that's the way the interview was too. And he would talk about what he was doing with the music. And one of the things that he stressed, which is contrary to popular belief, according to Dick Dale, he said, look, when I started out, I didn't do reverb. He said, that's not surf music. He said, I was trying to emulate the sound of the wave, and I would do that with my power guitars that he was pioneering for Leo Fender, who's one of the individuals behind the coming of solid-state electric guitars. And it really does change things in terms of rock and roll music and everything else. But anyway, in terms of Dick Dale, Dale, in the beginning, didn't get the credit that he deserved nationwide. Dick Dale, early on, from 1961 onward, was playing in large music halls throughout Southern California, sometimes pulling in 4,000 kids, packing into that music hall, basically doing the dance Surfer's Stomp. And Dick Dale's powerful guitar style certainly powered that forward. Now, that's on the one hand, in terms of one of the strains that you have in surf music early on. The other strain is going to come from the Beach Boys, who really weren't surfers themselves, like Dick Dale was a surfer. But with the exception of Carl Wilson, who did go out and surf.
I think it's Dennis. Dennis was the surfer.
Dennis Wilson, excuse me. With the exception of Dennis, what you have with the rest of the group is they weren't surfers. But Brian knew a good thing when he heard it, and he said, yeah, we'll give it a try. And they come up with various songs, obviously, that are going to establish that surf music as a genre. And what you have there, and it's phenomenal when you think about it, Nate, because here you have only a very small percentage of teenagers could surf. It had to be on those Southern California beaches. You're not going to do much surfing in Iowa or on Lake Erie or anywhere else, for that matter, in the United States. But yet that surf craze sweeps across the United States in the early 1960s. And I try to explain that in that chapter in terms of how surf music plugged into the times. It really picks up the optimism of that Kennedy era, that you could accomplish anything. One of the Beach Boys' early hits was a song called Don't Back Down. And that was the thrust of it, basically, that even their first major hit, Surfin' Safari, we're going to take on a Surfin' Safari, was almost magical in terms of what they're talking about. And it really plugs into the changes that are going on and the optimism of this youth culture during that time period. And one of the interesting things about it, and I never really thought much about this until I started writing that chapter. And as I was going through that chapter, I realized that unlike all of the other sounds that I discuss in the book, which always have a large number of African-American singers and performers and writers and everything else, surf music was almost 100% white. It totally goes in the opposite direction of the thrust of most early rock and roll. And I found myself asking, you know, why is that in terms of what's going on? And out of that question comes essentially the way I structured that chapter, trying to deal with surf music, that it plugs into the mythic American West, the same type of things that people were talking about, starting with even 1849 and the discovery of gold and the gold rush out to California, and that you're heading to California, there's that California dream, and you're going to find success. All you got to do is substitute things like gold rush to surfer, and that's where you find success. But it's going to be white males doing it in both cases. And what you're going to find is white males, and again, we're talking the time period here, that essentially males tended to dominate things and were seen as more active doing various types of things, from sports and everything else. And all of that comes together with surfing. In terms of the image of surf music. And that's kind of an abbreviated version of what I discussed in that chapter. But I think it's very important to try to plug surf music into these deeper strains in terms of American history and culture.
Yeah, the emergence of surf as kind of the first segregated strand of rock and roll, which is not going to be uncommon, unfortunately, from, say, 65 on. By the time you get to the late 70s, rock is brutally segregated, and you get crowds of white rock fans who are trained to boo black performers. They're not trained to, but you know, the Rolling Stones would have Stevie Wonder open up for him in 1973, and he would get booed off stage. As you know, Dusty Hill of ZZ Top said, who was on that same tour, Stevie Wonder. They booed Stevie Wonder, you know.
Yeah.
And so this emergence of surf is fascinating. I mean, Dick Dale, though, is ethnically rich. He's got this Arabic heritage. He brings a lot of these this Middle Eastern music into his music. Let's go ahead and hear Dick Dale's Miser Lou, which brings these Lebanese elements into surf rock. That was the great Dick Dale, king of surf rock, and his song Miser Lou, which a lot of people remember from the movie Pulp Fiction. And yeah, I've also done an episode that focused pretty heavily on Jan and Dean, and it was interesting. You know, Jan Barry's got very right-wing politics, and yet at the beginning, Jan and Dean were performing with people like Bobby Friedman, who was a black performer out of the Bay Area, and partying together. You know, it started out as this integrated scene. They would, the white kids, the surfer kids would go into the interior and, you know, places like Del Monte and hear, a lot of Hispanic bands and a lot of black bands. But at some point in the early 60s, the scene segregates. And I think it's a product of suburbs like Hawthorne, where the Beach Boys grew up, being segregated. Black folks were kept in Watts and Compton and not allowed to move closer to the beach. And there you go. We get the first white utterly white dominated genre of rock and roll and surf music. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about this old styles. You give a full section to the book of what you call old styles. And I want to talk about your schematics first, and then we'll talk about the big picture. We only have time to kind of talk about the big picture impressions. But I thought the way you divided up the scene was very useful and very comprehensive. You've got a category you call R&B rock. And this is groups like the Impressions, the Isley Brothers, also Gary U.S. Bonds, who's a totally great one-off, unique character coming out of Virginia in this time, doing some really interesting sonic innovations, like recording a new song that's him singing over a single instrumental that's already been recorded, like way, you know, presaging hip-hop. And then you've got this country category, and you put Elvis Presley in this category, but also Brenda Lee and the Everly Brothers. There's this, Roy Orbison's in the same mix. Had Buddy Holly lived, he would have been in there. There was this strong strain of Southern rockers in the 50s who kind of evolve into this, I don't want to say tamer, but yeah, I'll say tamer. a little bit tamer, okay. Style. Elvis was tamed. He was broken by the army, and a new Elvis emerges. That's what Tom Parker wanted to sell the American people. He's bringing in his operatic influences and expressing himself and working with great thrill-building songwriters like Doc Pomus and Mort Shuman, and doing some great stuff, but also doing new versions of O Sole Mio, very unusual stuff. Then you have a category you call pop rockers, and you put people like Dion and Ricky Nelson and Connie Francis in there, and also Pat Boone. You give a little bit of rehab to Pat Boone, and I might, if you want to, you can talk about that when I finish the whole run. I thought that was interesting. You don't often see defenses of Pat Boone. Then you have the second wave of pop rockers, and you include, Bobby V, Gene Pitney, Del Shannon, the Four Seasons, the whole Fabian and Frankie Avalon group out of Philly would be in that category as well. And then you talk about the radio, but also include kind of a miscellaneous section. So you have non-surfer instrumental groups like Duane Eddy or The Ventures. You have folk pop, which is immense from this whole period, from the time the Kingston Trio does Tom Dooley in 1959, and it's a massive number one hit. And then you have Marty Robbins with El Paso, similar ways. So you have this, college kids are really going for, think groups like the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul and Mary, Chad Mitchell, so many others, very kind of cleaned up. The children of the Weavers, like there was a distinction I think Woody Guthrie had between folk singers like himself and Lead Belly and singers who performed folk songs, people like Pete Seeger and the rest of the Weavers that weren't quote unquote folk, but did sing folk songs. And so a lot of these groups like Kingston Trio, I think, would have fallen on the other side of that line. He famously said Bob Dylan, of course, was a folk singer, which is interesting. But anyway, what's your big picture takeaway of these other trends that were not the cutting edge of the, the four categories that we talked about in the first section, but just give us the big picture takeaway on this whole section of the book.
All right. That section of the book, let me put it this way. It really is, because I struggled with that at the very beginning in terms of structurally. And what I realized is, as I was thinking about this, and here's where my own past in terms of a rock and roll fan and is in high school in the early 1960s comes into play here, paired with being an historian trying to put some kind of overview on this. What I realized is one of the big differences between today, let's say, in the music scene as compared to back then, and I cannot exaggerate this, is back then the power of top 40 radio. And with top 40 radio, I'm also including Dick Clark and American Bandstand, which is kind of leading the way there in terms of what's going on. But what you have as a result of that, unlike today, what you have with top 40 radio is no matter where teenagers lived in the United States, whether they lived in a small town in New Mexico or whether they lived in New York City or Tallahassee or Sheboygan or wherever, they were listening to the same songs, the same hits. And top 40 radio, dating back to its rise in the 1950s and in the early 1960s, it's going great guns. What happens there is top 40 radio included all sorts of stuff. And it wasn't just rock and roll, although that was the dominant style because teenagers were the ones listening to it. But also, if you sat down and listened to top 40 radio for an hour, you would hear everything from traditional rock and roll to, you know, all the latest hits in terms of surf music or Duane Eddy's latest instrumental, or the very next song after you might hear a song by, let's say, Wanda Jackson screaming out, "Let's have a party." The very next song could be something like Burt Kampfert's instrumental, pop instrumental, "Wonderland by Night." And kids listening to the radio back then didn't distinguish the way critics might today, didn't distinguish necessarily among these different sounds. If you heard it on top 40 radio, in the most broadest sense, it's part of the rock and roll landscape. Same thing with folk music. When Peter, Paul, and Mary arrive on the scene, I mean, it's going to cause a folk music revival in the United States, but for many white teenage girls across the United States, taking a look at Mary Travers with her beautiful, long, straight blonde hair, they would try to emulate that. In fact, I remember when I was interviewing Mary Travers, I asked her about that. I said, "Well, what's it like when you read that girls were actually trying to iron their hair so it would be straight like yours?" And she just kind of laughed and she said, "You know, it's crazy. What can I tell you in terms of that?" She said, I try not to let those things get to me. There are so many other big problems in the world in terms of what's going on. But it does show the power of top 40 radio. And one of the reasons that I used for that chapter title is it's Wild Weekend. It's an instrumental that becomes a major hit in the early 1960s by a group called The Rebels, not Duane Eddy's group, but this was a local garage band in Buffalo, New York. And that song originated as the theme song for a disc jockey on WKBW radio in Buffalo, Tom Shannon. It was the Tom Shannon Show, top tunes, news and weather. We'll all get together on Tommy Shannon Show, KB Radio. And that, when I hit on that, the whole chapter came together in terms of how do you work in all of these disparate sounds during this time period. And the answer was top 40 radio. And I can't overemphasize that, because to this day, I don't care where you go in the United States, and nowadays beyond the United States borders, people of a certain age group are going to know these songs because they would have heard them repeatedly when they were growing up. One of the things I do sometimes, Nate, when I go out and give a talk is I'll start up my talk and I'll say, look, here's what I want to do. This is what I'll tell the audience. I said, let me play a snippet of a song. And what I want you to do is tell me who sang the song, what the title of the song is, and if you can, what year. And usually, I remember once I started out, the first song I played was a snippet from Hound Dog, and the audience went crazy because, you know, everybody, unless you grew up on Pluto, you would know Hound Dog, particularly for the people attending this kind of a talk. And as we would move on, I would make the songs more and more obscure, and never even once did I stump an audience, no matter how obscure the song was. Not only could they tell you, you know, once I remember throwing out the song Baby Blue, that was done by the Echoes in 1961. It's one of these new doo-wop hits. And with that particular song, I said, okay, because they got the Echoes. I said, okay, then, what year was it? And they said, 1961. I said, okay, now let's see if you really know what you're talking about. What label it was on and what was the color of the label? And sure enough, there were several people in the audience who yelled out the right label and the color of the label. And that really tells you something about the cultural importance of that music. Here we are, 50 or 60 years later, and these aging baby boomers who listen to these songs on Top 40 radio know those songs. It's become part of the American songbook, really, in terms of that.
Absolutely.
It really it says the power of rock and roll as a cultural phenomenon.
Yes, and so many of the songs from this era, through their use in movies and TV shows, have gone on to become familiar to subsequent generations as well. So I think you've definitely demolished the idea that it was a dark age, that this was popular music, this was innovative music, this was music that communicated to its audience, and its audience was going through big changes, and this music documented it. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox. My guest has been Richard Aquila. The book is Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, A Cultural History of the Early 1960s. And Richard, thanks so much. I love the book. We didn't get to talk about rock and roll on the new frontier, but you've got some great analysis there about how Kennedy's vision of the future tied in with rock and roll. And tragically, you know, Kennedy didn't have a future, and the rest of the country went in a very different direction after his death. But this is a unique little period from 1960 to 1963, before the death of John F. Kennedy, before the arrival of the Beatles. Rock and roll had a renaissance. Richard, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Pete.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate and Ed Legg kick off a new Let It Roll miniseries looking at the 1980s. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.